In Marion Kettlewell, Reel 7. Yes, did you find that the attitudes changed even more regarding pregnancy?
Yes, particularly when I was Ren's training, near to training establishment at Berkeley, we were also responsible for drafting, and if any Ren's overseas were pregnant, they had to come back to Burfield for their discharge rehabilitation. And I noticed there a change. Originally, I felt the working class and the aristocracy, who I don't like using these words, but I don't know how else to put it, were much better and more natural in accepting this, and felt that perhaps this was going to be a grandchild rather than. But the sort of middle class wanted her to go to a home and for the baby to be adopted. And whether the Archers, that program on the radio, had anything to do with it, or whether or not, but about that time Jennifer got into trouble and was an expectant mother. And all the family, the grannies and on the Archers, their reactions were very well portrayed. I don't know which way around it was, whether the Archers were catching on to the change or whether the Archers helped in the change. But I felt after that there was a great change. And of course, it's nowadays, none of these homes exist as far as I know.
You felt that after this the middle class accepted more?
Yes, that's where I felt the change came. There was another instance. I was exercising my dog before Christmas up in Greenwich Park. I'd taken my car up, I think, because of the weather. And as I was getting back to my car, a very large West Indian approached me very courteously and said, could I choose, and he had some Christmas cards in his hand, three Christmas cards. Could I read him the words on the cards, because he wanted to decide who to send them to back home. And so in the middle of Greenwich Park, I just claimed this role, a trite verse. And then he said, well, perhaps I could write. So we leant on the bonnet of my car, and we wrote, and his greetings, and to his wife and his girlfriend and his mother, and then I addressed them. But that was just after they had appealed for the West Indians to come over here, and I didn't really realise what all the difficulties that were facing. The other big thing that happened to me with 6 weeks holiday in the university type holiday, and I was able to go to Nyasaland and fly a very old aircraft and visit my brother who was working out there in colonial service. At the end of my first year at Greenwich, to my surprise, I was promoted superintendent. And particularly surprised, not that I didn't expect to be promoted, because there were only two superintendents, and they were both in situ for, as far as we knew, 3 years, but one happily got married to a widowed naval officer, and so that was my good fortune. And It was the marriage, of course, that made for so many of our opportunities for promotion.
That must have been rather different than the men's case.
Very different indeed. And I felt very lucky because throughout my time in Wales, I'd never really been trained, you see, in the service there. So I found myself now on the flag officer's staff at Leon Stewart as superintendent air, and I was also on the staff of flag officer fine training, who was at the Overton. And I visited each air station 3 times a year, and with the admirals on inspections. And the admirals' inspections were really quite major occasions. The staff would be told to set up a temporary air station. Have all the parts and equipment put onto lorries ready to go, and if the runway had been damaged, of course then you went and saw all the naval Wrens of the naval air force rushing around getting all the different bits for the aircraft and having to know where they all were. And I made my first visit to the Overton by car, because I'd had a weekend with friends nearby. And the captain was very surprised and said, "Don't you like flying?" Well, I did like flying, and I'd flown quite a lot. And so I said, "Oh, I don't mind, I'll go up in anything you like, I love it." Well, that afternoon I was put up in a Hunter, and we climbed high over the channel and came through the sound barrier because he wanted to make me a supersonic superintendent. That was splendid. And I flew again often in the Clipper and sometimes in Vampires and Hunters and quite a number of helicopters.
But what was it like going supersonic?
Well, not, it didn't really. The pilot said put your foot on the pedal, because of course the aircraft in which I was flying was dual for training, so, and I could just feel, but I didn't know. Although I did feel a bit tired afterwards, I think, and sometimes if one looped the loop or anything on other occasions and got G,
Was it very different being a superintendent, though? You know, this higher rank. Did you?
Yes, I did. I think the Navy was so meticulous when you arrived anywhere. They turned out the same sort of number of people, the captain, the commander, as they would for a naval captain, and they did always treat you with much, which I think came as a bit of a surprise to me, but one much appreciated.
It is a very high rank, though, isn't it, in the Navy? Captain or superintendent.
It is the equivalent of a captain, but.
Yes, and did you have, were you getting the gold braid?
Oh no, I was never in the time of the gold braid. That was much more. I know no good thing of dates, but it was almost into the 90s.
But you were saying earlier, you know, I remember being very impressed when you told me about your lovely doeskin uniform that you had made in the war. Yes, I suppose you had to be very careful about your the spit and polish and appearance, did you, as a superintendent?
But also, one was very fortunate in having a leading Roman steward who seemed to look after a uniform for me. And in my case, she always insisted on looking after my dog. I was quite happy to take my dog to the office, but my leading Roman wouldn't let me. She liked company. And I was very fortunate in having some very delightful stewards to do all that for me. And,
I was in the
naval officer's mess, which was marked progress, I suppose. And I, apart from my breakfast, but I had upstairs, I took my meals in the naval officer's mess. And of course, there was one or two of the airborne staff who also lived in the mess, which was for the whole of HMS area, all that. But to get back, we were talking about flying. I did, as far as possible, I always went to an air station by air, and the flag officers and encouraged it. But what I found particularly was that it gave encouragement to the Wrens who were involved. And the Wren air mechanics thought they were rather a lowly group, which they weren't. They were very highly qualified, and it gave them a boost. If you fuel in the aircraft, they'd maintain that sort of thing. And also, you learned a lot about the flying and the hazards and the difficulties and the joys and the weather and the problems.
I remember you saying before that you thought this was very important to understand fully the demands of a job.
Yes.
This you carried that right the way through.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think the naval officers appreciated this, and that you weren't just there to sort of coddle the Wrens in cotton wool or anything. And they were there to do so, and you could understand more about it. And the range assessors up at Lossiemouth, I had a splendid day with them. I went up in the duty helicopter, which always went up when the naval planes were doing their bombing practice. And they bombed a rocky islet off Cape Ross. And the Wren range assessors was sat in three points around Cape Ross, sheltered by aircraft crates, you know, the engines come in great crates, and these had been anchored in different places where the Wrens with their instruments could take the measurements of the bombing. And this helicopter, which was up there on duty, took me around to the different, and dropped me off to talk to the Wrens while they were doing their work. I actually didn't oversee Ford out there. And then at lunchtime, the helicopter landed at the local small hotel in the car park, and we had lunch. The only thing was, I had to wear a wetsuit all day, which is rather restricting for women, but I could manage. And I found that extremely interesting. Flying back in a helicopter over Scotland to Lochiel over the Highlands was again a lovely thing. After I'd been director of them, Lossie gave me a farewell and they flew me in a Hunter low level all over Scotland. That was my farewell up at Lossie. And when I was director of the Wren office, first officers used to come down for a meeting once a year, and I always tried to arrange some outside talk. And at this time, I got the surgeon captain, who was a psychologist, from the local hospital to come and give a talk on lesbians and homosexuals, because this was beginning to be more openly talked about. And again, I think we were very lucky. We didn't have many problems. But I had always found I'd known this Durban captain, well, when he was serving lieutenant commander at Chatham, and he was always very helpful with any psychiatric problems or. And I think I only remember about 3 rounds being released as not suitable on that particular side.
Was it understood then, you know, homosexuality? Was there, you know, because I imagine things have changed
it
quite
was
a lot.
Little talked about or realised, and that's why I wanted people to, the Renault sisters, have a natural understanding and approach to it. No, I think it was very, very, it must have been there, but I know as far as we were concerned, it didn't exist. And
would that have been the same with the men, do you think, you know, in the Navy?
The Navy, because of the, if there was any, I think they were much more aware of it from the ship angle, because I understand that if you had a relationship of that sort on board, it was very upsetting to the morale of the ship. On this, just at this time, Lord Carrington, who was Minister of Defence, told Dame Jean Davis, who was our director, that the Wren officer's mess dress looked as if we were penguins. And so she got somebody to design a new thing in a different shade of blue. Ours was black and white. I suppose we could look like penguins, but so did the naval officers. And we were all horrified, the senior and officers, by this, but we got a new mess dress. And
you weren't consulted at all?
Well, we said, when we when she showed. We had a demonstration at the Wren's quarters in London, and we said we didn't like it, but it went ahead nonetheless. And I gave mine to the War Museum at Naval Museum at Greenwich, and I expect it's packed away in a box where it should be to be back. At the end of the year, the doctors, I was dined out at an S dinner.
Oh, 3 years at Lee, was it? And 3 years, yes, I beg
you. 3 years at Lee. I was dined out and then next day I drove out of the establishment with the captain and others waving me, as they kindly did, and went up to the Wren's new entry training establishment and drafting headquarters, which was at HMS Dauntless at Burfield, just outside Reading. Now, the interesting thing here, I was in charge, I wasn't in command, because not being under the Naval Discipline Act, a naval officer had to be in command. And he was a Commander Burfield, who was commanding officer of HMS President in London, and he was very tactful, he only appeared now and again, and we did have one seaman there who was usually on compassionate draft, and he helped with the sort of cleaning and things that chaps could do, and we had most excellent ship's company of officers and ratings, and the quality of the recruits was good. The accommodation had been for an ammunition depot, the workers had lived down there were wooden huts with single rooms for each person, which was unusual. And the superintendent had the bungalow at the bottom, which had two bedrooms and a dining room and a small sitting room and a kitchen. And we also had a sick bear and a staff with a surgeon, lieutenant commander, and a nursing sister, and the ADs. And when I got there, it was understood that HMS Dauntless, the women's training, was going to stay separate to the men, and that the place would be rebuilt with proper permanent buildings. And I have to give the credit to the first officers. There were three at Fairfield, the officer in charge of admin and training, the quarters officer, and the drafting post officer. But all the drafting of rounds was still done by the men. And they came to me and they said it was a wrong place to rebuild the men's training place. We should be near a main port, like Portsmouth. And as it was, each training course that came in, and they came in every week, the different men's. They had to go in a bus down to Portsmouth for their x-rays, because we had no x-ray. Having worked out all the different pros and cons of this, I approached the director and with the agreement of the CNC, the rebuilding of Dauntless was cancelled. And then they started. Then it was no longer up to me. And they started looking at places like HMS Guard near Portsmouth, where the Wrens would have their own building. In fact, what happened quite a while later was that they rebuilt in HMS Riley, down opposite, across the water at Plymouth. And I had always thought that that was too far away, that the Wren recruits, say from Scotland or other parts of England, would have found it a long way to go and they might have been homesick, but that is why the men went for their early training. And it worked for the men, so it, although it took a long time, it was probably, in the end, we had a separate building. But now they're all integrated. They don't use that building for the men before. They've been put into a block just for the same as the men. Dauntless, we also have three splendid chaplains. One, the First England naval chaplain, was on the permanent staff and lived nearby. But we also had a local minister for the non-conformists who came in once a week and to run services. And we had, for the Roman Catholics, we had a priest from Dye Abbey. The first one was rather elderly and his eyes only lit up when you talked to him. But we then had a younger one who was an enormous actor. And they used to take their church services. But also on special Sundays, these three chaplains all got on extremely well together. And sometimes, which was unusual for the 60s, they all would put on a joint service together, say on Good Friday or something like that. And they were a great team and very helpful. And when a Wren steward which were Roman Catholic, wanted to marry her boyfriend without her parents knowing because of the faith. This priest from Bari was just the right man to sort it out, and in the end she was married in, at Bari with her parents, who came up and they had the reception and daughters. So, and we had tremendous, of course there were regular passing out parades because the training was only about 1 month, and we never lacked like for people to come and take the salute from the First Sea War in the commander to the series of different establishments. And once we had Madame Prunier from who owned the big restaurant, fish restaurant, and things, and she had given the cookery prize for the inter-service competition, and the Wrens had won it, and so she came down and put the salute in the centre. And she stayed to lunch, and the one thing we didn't serve was fish. We bought some people making that, but she was very impressed with the standard of the stewards, and the cook. We also had our own pantomimes and concerts. The first officer had also been with me in HMS series, where she ran the choir, and she was also very good at producing plays and pantomimes, and we had regular dances, and usually the army came to support that. And as duty, as drafting officer, I was responsible too for the staff of checkers. Sometimes it was army, and sometimes it was RAF, sometimes it was mixed. I can't remember how the different changes came about. But it was not one that the Wrens found easy. I mean, there were a lot of it they enjoyed, but it was very isolated. There were no other naval establishments near. There was an RAF one. There was a very helpful housekeeper. But of course, all the work was usually at the weekend. And nothing to do perhaps in the week. And that wasn't.
Yes, who would have been in office at that time? At Chequers?
Well, part of the time actually was there. I can't remember what it was all over the time, but he was there. The lady actually wasn't all that easy. But the housekeeper was there, not I was going to talk to her. Also, during that time, the BBC did a programme called Women, 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 and they had a half hour in which they, I can't remember how long the series went on for, but they did different aspects of women. They did one of women students at Sussex University, which was absolutely ghastly when we saw it. Couldn't think why we'd ever agreed to take part. But then they did another one about an Irish couturier in Dublin, and that was most deliciously and interesting, well done. So we took part and they came down and filmed us for 2 days. And again, this first officer who was the mess president too and had the next speech at the mess dinner, which they filmed. We were entertaining the officers from Dryad, I think, at the time. And so, when they both made their speeches, the commander from Dryad and the first officer, they were asked to do it all over again, which they did somehow, but not easy to make your speech effective in the same way. And they featured one, this first officer and her background, and one of the ship's company and one of the recruits being seen off by her parents and met at the station and so on. And
were you in it? Would you have featured?
I didn't feature as I was in the and part of the inspection in the that side, but not commented. I thought about